What's something that works so well that it's basically magic? This time of year, I think of air conditioning. But selling with Shopify is also seamless. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling chess courses, merch, software services, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person point-of-sale system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify's magic, which is your AI-powered all-star. When I was running an online teaching business, enabling seamless online payment saved me many hours of work and helped me focus on what I enjoy. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries use it, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. So if you sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/chess, that's all lowercase, shopify.com/chess, to sign up to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in growing it. Shopify.com/chess. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. Can you believe it is time for another World Championship match preview? The World Championship between Ding Liren and Gukesh, of course, is taking place in November, on November 23rd to December 13th in Singapore. What we're going to do, as usual, is go through a few of the sort of factual details, what time of day the matches are, the time control format, stuff like that. And then we've got three different guests here to talk about it. We've got Grandmaster Davorin Kolyasevich, who, of course, wrote Ding Liren's best game, so knows Ding's games inside and out. He's first up. Then we have Cyrus Lakdawala, who's got a new biography out on Gukesh, discussing what he learned from annotating 70 of Gukesh's games and what makes Gukesh so special, and he thinks actually possibly an all-time great. And then I always like to look at the match from a statistical angle as well. And coming back to join us and help preview it is National Master Matt Jensen of Chess Goals. Matt always does great work around the probabilities based on different ratings. And he's got some hot takes on what he thinks could happen in this particular match. So as always, the timestamps of the guests and of my jibber jabber are in the description. So if you'd like to skip ahead to the interviews, go ahead. But I did want to share a few details, some of which I didn't know about this match until I started to dig in. Number one, the games are at a rough time for those of us in the United States. The games are at 5 p.m. Singapore time, but that's 4 a.m. Eastern time here in the U.S., which actually, for classical chess, for me personally, it's not that bad, because if I get up at 7 a.m., it's like the opening phase is coming to an end. I wish it were a little bit later, but I will get to see the most tense moments of the game. Might be a little bit different if you're in California, and obviously adjust accordingly if you're in Europe. The timing of the game format is three games on, then one day off. Three games on, then one day off. It's a 14-game match. First to 7.5 points wins. The prize fund is up to $2.5 million. They've got some new sponsors, and I like the way that FIDE has arranged the prize fund. You get $200,000 per win, and the remainder is split. So that's one thing to keep in mind if the match should turn out to be lopsided, is there's additional incentive for whoever's ahead to keep pushing rather than to coast. The time control for each game is 120 minutes per side for the first 40 moves and 30 minutes for the rest of the game, with a 30-second increment per move starting on move 41. So as in other recent world championships, there's no increment early in the match, and that can really lead to some tense time trouble. We've seen it in some matches before, and we may see it in this one as well. A few basic facts about the players involved. You guys probably know this, but Gukesh, of course, 18 years old. 2783 is his rating as I record this on November 1st. Number five in the world currently. He could be the youngest ever world championship, as you'll hear me say a couple times in this pod. Really has a chance to put himself on a unique historical trajectory, and has been playing great. I mean, not great in his very most recent tournament, but obviously on like a year-over-year trajectory has been really doing incredible and showing tremendous strength. Ding, on the other hand, of course, is far off of his peak. 32 years of age, his rating is 27-28. His peak was 28-16 in November of 2018. So obviously a lot of the discussion in these conversations is about which Ding will we see? He'll be able to shore up his weaknesses and put his best foot forward and play the closer to the way that he was playing in 2018. Grandmaster Kolyasevich also tries to sort of explain what's different about the way that Ding is playing from a grandmaster perspective. Matt Jensen, as you'll hear, I mean, he just highlights that the age is always a factor, and the younger player often does well in the small sample we have of world championship matches. So it's the consensus, both of the people I interviewed and other people I've discussed the match with and see discussing it online, is most people, of course, favor Gukesh, as do the betting markets. But you never know, and we're hoping for an entertaining match most of all. So that's about it for the details I think you need to know. As always, wanted to thank our sponsors, Chessable.com. If to get in the world championship mood, you want to go through some chess history, they have courses like Kasparov's, my great predecessors. Amazing that it's there. Jan Timman's got some courses on the all-time greats. And of course, if you sign up for Chessable Pro, be sure to use the link in the description. So without further ado, the guests are Grandmaster Davorin Kolyasevich discussing primarily Ding Liren, Cyrus Lakdawala discussing primarily Gukesh, and then Matt Jensen and I take a look at the stats behind the match, compare it to the betting markets, how likely is it to go to tiebreak, which of course would be a faster time control, and all of that stuff. So I hope you all enjoy this. There will be some coverage of the match here on the podcast during the World Championship as well. Try to wrangle a few people in Singapore, although the time difference will not be. We'll make it a challenge, but I'm excited to discuss the match as it goes on, and I hope you all enjoy it. So let's get you to this preview, starting with Grandmaster Davorin Kolyasevich. And we are here with a return guest, good friend of the pod. He is a renowned author, Chessable author, trainer, and player, probably best known for the excellent book, How to Study Chess on Your Own, which, of course, we've discussed in prior podcasts with our guests. And most recently, he's been publishing accompanying workbooks through New in Chess that are also excellent resources. He's also a very knowledgeable trainer and accomplished player. And he also wrote a great biography of GM Ding Liren, Ding Liren's Best Games, A Chess Biography of the World Champion. We actually discussed it some in our last interview in October of 2023, episode 353. But I wanted to bring our guest back to get an update on Ding's games and hear his thoughts on the World Championship. So welcome, as always, welcome back to Grandmaster Davorin Kolyasevich. Welcome, Davorin.
Thank you, Ben. Always great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for popping back on. So again, we discussed Ding in detail, and I really enjoyed your book, as I've mentioned before. But I thought it would be a good time to get an update. And obviously, the mental health issues that Ding has discussed, which I think it's commendable he's discussed openly, we want to be respectful and not speculate too much. So I thought we would start with the chess. Obviously, his performance is way down. I mean, he had a peak rating of 28-16 when he was comfortably top five in the world. His live rating is 27-28, number 23 in the world. So as someone who studied his games, as you mentioned in our prior interview in your book, you're a big fan of his, even as a fellow grandmaster. What do you see that's different in his chess when you look at his recent games?
Yeah, I mean, without going into the reasons why, it's pretty clear that he's playing with less energy. He's not taking as many risks as he did before. And in critical moments, he often goes for some, you know, settles for something safe. And if you look at his games from recent tournaments, like maybe last 6 months, you can see that he's getting good positions, actually. A lot of times with, you know, against Caruana, against Abdusatorov twice, he had like winning positions almost. And somehow the critical moment comes and he doesn't really exploit it. So that's like, you know, maybe if he won a couple of those games, his confidence would improve, and not only his rating, but just in general, like he would get a momentum that I think he's missing. So I think that's mostly it. Probably lack of confidence in those critical moments. And he has had some blunders, we've seen. And that could, you know, maybe he was affected by just bad results, and then, you know, it kind of snowballs from there. But I think the trend is that his form has been improving ever so slightly. Starting from February, he played, you know, had a horrible tournament in Germany. And then already in Sinkfield Cup, he had some good positions. Okay, didn't convert, lost some games he probably shouldn't have. But then in the Olympiad, he was quite solid. And I'm hoping to see like this positive trend, you know, continuing.
Yeah, it's funny hearing you talk about the issues, because it's like they're so common for club players, you know, the lack of confidence, the lack of willingness to sort of pull the trigger and play the aggressive line, and just the sort of, mental trickery that chess can play on you, where confidence can be so fragile, where if you just don't have that extra edge, it can be so much harder to sustain good results. And if anything, to me, it highlights just how amazing these top players are, that you don't see issues like this all that often, that they can be so resilient.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say it goes vice versa. I mean, once you get that confidence, you start building on that. You know, you can see probably with Gukesh, it's the opposite.
Right.
When he started, you know, notching these good results, and, you know, now he's a top 5-10 player in the world.
Yeah, we're going to have Cyrus Lakdawala, who just wrote a book about Gukesh, on as well. But what are your overall impressions of Gukesh as a player?
Well, I really like his style. He seems to be, you know, this kind of principal player who always wants to find the best move in every kind of position. And he's had this momentum, has a lot of confidence. So obviously his results are great. The candidates win was impressive, and his Olympiad was impressive. So yeah, I definitely am looking forward to, to see how his career is going to continue, and seeing that book by Cyrus to check some of those games. Because he does have some really impressive games.
Yeah, and again, seems to be gathering momentum heading into the match. Nepo, after the candidates, maybe it was sour grapes or sort of prisoner of the moment type reaction, but he had said he wasn't that impressed with how Gukesh played, and sort of suggested he picked on the lower rated players in the field, which of course is what you need to do to win the candidates. What was your reaction to those comments?
Well, you know, top players know those things better. I mean, I'm sure Nepo has a better feel for his peers. But nevertheless, I think only Prague and him beat the lowest rated player in the candidates with 2-0.
Yeah, Abasov,
yeah. But he did beat some other players. So,
oh, for sure.
Ferrugia, yeah. I think. He's definitely there, you know, he's top 10 player.
Yeah.
I'm sure the other top players have their thoughts, but in terms of just his playing style, I really like his.
Yeah. Well, I'll be discussing Gukesh more with Cyrus. So let's bring it back to Ding. Obviously, he's known primarily for sort of a classical opening repertoire, although he did spring some surprises in the last World Championship match. Do you have any expectations in terms of what openings he might play, or is it just too hard to predict these days?
I was actually expecting him to branch into 1-e4 after the match, because he was sort of suggesting that after the World Championship match with Nepo. But I've seen him play a couple of games with 1-e4. One was in the Olympiad. But I don't think he's going to use it in the match, maybe as a surprise in one game. But I think we can expect the usual solid, classical repertoire with maybe, you know, d4 obviously as a base, and maybe some English opening sprinkled in, and maybe even a London system, which he used quite successfully. But then also, I'm not sure if he you know, maybe he's just like has this grand scheme of fooling everyone, and you know, he's gonna start playing something completely different in the World Championship match. It's hard to tell, you know. It depends who his seconds are. I don't know who he's been working with. It was mostly a surprise. I mean, sort of a secret for the previous match, except we knew the Rapport was there, but we didn't know, I think, about his other second and his seconds in China. So,
yeah, and if memory serves, we didn't know about Rapport until he was there. Not like we knew in advance. Now, I did see online that Rapport was not at the European Club Cup, so people are speculating that maybe he's on the team again. We don't know this time if there'll be like a leaked online account where he's practicing his openings. Yeah. And in terms of what you were saying about openings, I have to think, and I want to be respectful, don't want to speculate too much, but to the extent that his confidence might not be at its peak, that sort of makes me suspect he might be less adventurous in the opening and might just want to rely on what he knows best. And also, as you said, his openings haven't really been the issue. So it's more about converting and showing that fifth gear. And actually, Eugene Perelstein, I'm not sure where he was referring to Magnus's quote, but he tweeted the other day, I'll read you this tweet. He said, Magnus said it best about the upcoming Gukesh versus Ding match. Ding has the ability, but not the confidence. If Gukesh strikes first, it may be a lopsided match, but the longer it goes without a result, Ding's confidence will grow as well. So do you see that as a potential scenario where he's just solid at the beginning? Because I sort of feel like that's how he beat Nepo. Like he was teetering. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're in a playoff and he played on instinct and he won, you know?
That's one of the possible scenarios. Yeah. It's not that likely. I mean, clearly this interview referring to, this was Magnus giving, I think, to Chessbase India, giving an interview just like yesterday, 2 days ago.
Okay.
And I think he said something, along those lines, where if the match drags on, Ding's chances improve. But he also said, like, if Gukesh strikes first, then it's going to be very difficult for Ding. Or I think he even said, like, it's going to be impossible for Ding to bounce back. But I don't know, because Ding has done it before. We've seen he was trailing, I think, what, three times in that match against Nepo. And he was on the ropes in the last game, and he managed to save the true Ken game. So will he have that same resilience this time? It's less likely, clearly, because of his psychological state. But it seems to me that, at least if we talk about that, that he's come to terms with it, at least, you know, over time. He can talk about it openly, and I think he's accepted it, that he's going to have some bad days. But at the start of the year, I think it was quite obvious he was struggling with it.
Yeah. And Ding, of course, to his credit, has been pretty open talking about the 9 months he took off from chess, dealing with some mental health issues after the World Championship. And he's done a few interviews since then. He did an interview with Chessbase India in August of 2024, where he said, "My current state is neither exceptionally good nor bad. As I felt over the past 1.5 years, I've moved past the deepest or worst moments. I know I've been playing great chess. I just couldn't win certain positions. I still believe I can turn that around, maybe during the match." So again, it's like, it's so honest that you really appreciate that. But at the same time, to me, it doesn't like inspire a tremendous amount of confidence that like he's just raring to go.
Yeah, it's like someone might hope that he's going to make this turnaround psychologically and in his play, but it's not, I wouldn't give it a big, you know, probability. But with that said, I think he is improving. And in the match, you never know, because it can go in different directions. And another thing I was going to say, when you mentioned that, you know, Gukesh had this big momentum, I don't know if you followed, but in the last tournament, he played the European Club Cup last week. Gukesh didn't do well.
Right.
He struggled with time pressure a lot, even against lower-rated opponents. And he performed, you know, way below his level. And I was thinking that maybe, you know, he might have reached that point at the Olympiad where he was in peak form, and now maybe he's like was getting a little bit playing too much, perhaps, because in the last 2 years he's played, I think, close to 200 classical games. So, you know, at some point you need a break, and maybe he didn't need that tournament in European club, you know, in the club cup. So it shows that maybe, you know, Ding might have some chance just because Gukesh is not in the greatest form.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, the World Championship is coming right up, so he won't have an extended break.
Right, right. And he needs to prepare his lines and so on. So if we're just talking in terms of probability of winning the match, you know, now maybe it has decreased a little bit for Gukesh, but it doesn't have to mean anything, you know. We are hoping first and foremost for a very good match, you know, in terms of game quality.
Yeah, are you excited for the match? I know chess fans are all over the place because obviously there's no Magnus, but are you personally excited?
Yeah, I am. For Ding, mostly, but like I said, I like Gukesh too. So whoever wins, you know, it's gonna be you know, nice to have him as a world champion. But I do hope that Ding will somehow pull through. It would be another Cinderella story.
Yeah, it would be a great story. Although I do, from talking to people, like there is this a lot of people I think have the sense where they're just like, I hope it's close. I hope Ding, if not his best foot forward, puts like close to his best foot forward.
Yes.
Yeah. And as we wrap up, Davern, do you like, what could I get you to put a probability on the match? Like how likely you think Ding and or Ding and Gukesh are each to win?
I mean, if I were like completely objective, probably I would say 80 to 20 for Gukesh.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I have to double check this, and I will. This is the first segment I'm recording of this, but I think the betting market's around 75% for Gukesh. Yeah. And it's just tough.
I was checking their performances for last year, like since the World Championship match with Nepomniachtchi, and Gukesh performed around 2750 in all his classical games, and Ding below 2700. So I'm sure that, you know, bookies look at things like that. But I mean, Gukesh has not been super consistent also in this period. So he had some, even before the candidates, I think he had one tournament in Czech Republic where he didn't do his best. He lost some games. So it will be a lot about, you know, whether Ding can get back to at least like, I don't know, 70-80% of his previous form. And then if Gukesh is in slightly off form, then we could see a real match. But if it's like similar to what they've been performing for the last year and a half, you have to give it to Gukesh.
Yeah. And I guess there's always some slight chance. I mean, Gukesh obviously has shown remarkable nerves, especially the way he bounced back against Ali Reza and the candidates. He seems pretty unflappable, but this is a different animal, you know, highest stakes match of his career, most eyeballs on him. He's, you know, he's only 18. So there has to be at least some chance that maybe, you know, even if it's only early in the match, maybe there's like an early stumble, which could obviously alter the probabilities and give us what we want in terms of like a fighting match.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, well, we will see. Davern, obviously, usually our interviews are longer. Usually you're very insightful on chess improvement. I asked you before we're recording, but other than doing your lessons and working with the groups that you work with, you don't have any big projects in the works right now, correct?
Not right now, but maybe next year I will have a project with New in Chess and Quality Chess, a chess book. We've had
okay,
some.
Excellent.
It's in the pipeline. So.
Okay, always excited for that. Any other chess related observations, whether about the match or anything else you'd like to share before we say goodbye for now?
Well, about the match, I do hope, I was going to say this earlier, you know, there hasn't been, speaking of the book about Dinglerand, there hasn't been a game he's played in the last, you know, year and a half that would be worthy of the book.
Right.
And I know, you know, I mentioned in that book, like some of his key core qualities that he's been showing since he was young were, you know, aggressive, you know, risk-taking, sacrificing material, exploiting weaknesses and so on. And he hasn't really been showing that. So I really hope that, you know, he will play at least a couple of games with that in that spirit. And maybe that's something that could shake his opponent in the match, who may not be expecting that kind of play, based on how Ding has been playing recently. So that's my hope for the match.
Yeah, I hope so too. That's a good observation. Okay, well, Devran, it's always fun, and definitely keep me posted about your next project. Would love to chat. I know it's always a long way from talking about something to doing it, but whenever it's ready, I'd love to chat again.
Great.
After the break, we will talk about Grandmaster Gukesh D with IM Cyrus Lakdawala. We'll be right back.
Curious about investing in crypto? Start with Grayscale. They have over a decade of experience managing crypto investment products, many of which are available right in your investment account. Search for a Grayscale product ticker today. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. For more information and important disclosures, visit grayscale.com.
And we are here with another return guest, a friend of the pod, the popular and insanely prolific. He tells me he's up to 70 books. The most recent and most pertinent one for this conversation being From Boy to Man to Challenger, The Fiercest Battles of Gukesh D. So I'm excited to welcome back to the program and to do a brief deep dive on the genius of Gukesh D. Welcome back. I am Cyrus Lakdawala.
Hi there, Ben. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, excited to chat, and I enjoyed your book. Got me really impressed with this young man. And where I wanted to start, Cyrus, is when I interviewed Jan Timman previewing the candidates that Gukesh won, he actually predicted that Gukesh would win. But as you point out in your book, and as I remember from being Facebook friends with you, you also tapped Gukesh beforehand. So we'll get into what has impressed you subsequently about Gukesh, but what made you think he was being undervalued going into the candidates?
I felt that he was underrated because he just reminds me a lot of the young Karpov. Everybody said that about Karpov before he became world champion, because his style is so unassuming. It just feels like he doesn't have talent when he's actually immensely talented. You know, like Karpov would just move around and then, oh, look, I won. You know, like
right.
I watched Karpov, I remember, at the World 30-Minute Championship. We both have a lot in common since we're both world champions. I won the under 2400 section. So I am a world champion, Ben. I am.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Nobody can take that away from me. And anyway, Karpov, I remember this game against Torre where Karpov had a knight and Torre had a bishop, and it just looked so drawn. And Karpov just randomly moved the knight around in the ending. It looked like he was just making random waiting moves. And then just by magic, like 15, 20 moves later, it's like, oh, he's winning. Like,
right.
What happened? Like, I mean, I swear I didn't notice how he got the one position. It was just like a abracadabra. I'm winning now, you know? And Gukesh has exactly that feel. He just makes unassuming moves, sometimes odd moves, you know, like very like, why did you do that? And then 15 moves later, you see why. It's a kind of Capablanca thing too. Like there's a flow and a harmony to the play, not to the level of Capablanca, who was more like the Mozart of chess, but almost. You know,
yeah, and he's only 18, so
that's the thing. He has, you know, he could be how much better 10 years from now when he reaches his absolute prime, right, in his late 20s.
Yeah, and as you write, one of the impressive things about him is the sort of outside of chess factors that look very promising. You write, Gukesh's sources of power are his sober maturity, his intense work ethic, his mental toughness, and his strong nerves. Good things to have for a world championship match.
He has the ideal personality. I mean, he looks the guy looks like he has very low blood pressure. Okay. He doesn't look, Ding is a great player, but like has that Ivanchuk issue. Nerves, you know,
that's
like
a good analogy. Like, yeah.
You know, just like, Ding obviously has been in a horrific slump since becoming world champion. Something altered in his mind, you know, like since becoming world champion. Maybe it's that, I don't know if it's an that imposter syndrome where you, I certainly feel that, you know, like I'm like this total doofus who's famous, like how, like how did it happen? You know, but I think imposter syndrome could be, I'm not a psychologist, you know, and I don't know, but he says that he's fighting clinical depression.
Yeah.
And that's a serious thing. I mean, if he's, even if you're taking drugs for it while you're playing, that will totally affect your play.
Yeah.
You know, you can't have drugs which are affecting your mind. Like, I mean, except for caffeine maybe, and, you know, but I think it may alter your move choices. It may change the way you decide things, and that could fundamentally alter how you play chess.
Yeah, it definitely adds an element of challenge. And in your book, of course, you annotate 70 Gukesh games, including his games against the world champions, including Ding, of course, who he has a minus score against, against Magnus. But despite these rightful concerns about Ding, you do write in your book that you feel that he's being underestimated. So how do you balance that? I mean, obviously, we're all impressed with Gukesh. I think you in particular, as we'll get into more. But Ding, you still feel like he might be underestimated?
Look, the world championship is on the line. You don't become world champion by being this weak person who collapses. Okay, Ding, that match with Nepomniachtchi was one of the greatest matches of all time, in my opinion. Okay, it showed unbelievable tenacity on Ding's part. It was like he was losing the entire match all the way through, except for the last game where he wins. You know, it's like he was either tied or losing the entire match. He was never ahead. Okay. And then they get into the Rapids, and his decision in that final game was amazing. I remember, I think it was Caruana and someone else, commentating on that game, that the final game that Ding won.
The South Pin.
Yeah. And Ding had, I remember, 1.5 minutes to Nepomniachtchi's 3. Ding was up a pawn, but he would have to go into this super dangerous looking self pin, and they were saying there's no way he'll play rook g6 and self pin, not zero chance, zero, boom, rook g6. And then from that point, he played like a bloody machine.
Yeah.
Completely outplayed Nepomniachtchi in the blitz, spotting him 1.5 minutes, finding exclam after exclam. You don't do that if your nerves are weak, okay? Or if you're like this guy that falls apart under pressure, okay? If his head is clear, it's going to be a really close match. Ding, I predicted Ding would beat Nepomniachtchi, by the way, before that match. And I know most people picked Nepomniachtchi, but I felt Ding was the second best player in the world at that time. He was also being underestimated. I noticed that there's this kind of bigotry racism. It's racism to positional players. Like me. You're all racists. Okay, anyway, like if a player is dynamic, everybody says the dynamic guy is going to win. If the guy is, like, how many players I remember in the first Karpov-Kasparov match, you know, everybody said, oh, Kasparov, you know, well, Karpov is the world champion. Karpov is higher rated. Why are you picking Kasparov, right?
Yeah. I mean,
that was that match that was canceled. And at one point, Karpov was up 5-0.
Yeah, that was an incredible match. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but he couldn't win that sixth game because he had a physical collapse, basically. Yeah. Kasparov's brilliant strategy in that match was just keep drawing and then just completely exhaust Karpov, and it worked. And I think he probably would have won that match, actually. Karpov lost, like, I forgot at the end, but he basically just kept losing games. He lost, like, three games in rapid succession, right? And
yeah,
he may have kept going. I mean, he may have won a game and won the match, but I think Kasparov was a slight favorite, even though he was down 5-3 at the when the match was canceled.
Yeah. So for listeners not familiar with that amazing bit of chess history, Jan Timman wrote a book called The Longest Game about their matches. And yeah, that one in particular, the first one that they ended up, as Cyrus said, canceling, well worth reading up on and researching. Yeah, but that taught FIDE the lesson that you need a finite number of games.
Right.
You can't just have it be you win a certain amount. So Cyrus, so I've gotten predictions from the other guests on this podcast. What do you think? Who is your pick, and what kind of probability would you assign?
There's two predictions. Okay. One is if Ding can't fix his head, okay, it's going to be a bloodbath. It'll be +4 for Gukesh, okay, or plus. I mean, it could be he loses like every other game, right?
Yeah.
If he can fix his head, it could be just +1 for Gukesh or +2 maybe, you know? It's a short match too. You know, 12 games is not a lot. And one loss could be it, right? Because these guys know how to not lose a chess game. They go into that no lose mode.
Yeah.
Even playing horribly as Ding has in the last year, I think he knows how to not lose. If he just manages to win, let's say he wins two games early because Gukesh is overconfident, which I don't think will happen. I think Ding would win that match. He knows how to hold draws. He knows how to play solid chess, you know. He's not some weak player, even messed up. He's not a weak player. Like, people are acting like he's a 1300, you know. He's the world champion.
You do think even if he plays stable, you would still favor Gukesh.
I still favor Gukesh. Gukesh, I think, is headed to be him and Iragassi are unreal right now.
Yeah.
Okay, they're on track to be the two strongest players of all time. Okay,
yeah,
I mean, like in the range of Kasparov and Carlsen strong, you know, Fischer strong.
Yeah.
That's strong. Ding was never like a Fischer world champion or a, you know, like a Kasparov or even a Karpov world champion. I mean, but Gukesh is a potential like elite level world champion, like a candidate maybe for greatest player of all time if you give him 10 years.
Now, do you say that based on the fact that he qualified at his age or based on what you observe from studying his games in such detail?
Both. There's an underwater feel to his games, you know, like on the surface, it just looks so non-threatening, just like a young Karpov, you know, but he's relentless. He just plays and plays and plays, kind of like Carlsen does in drawn endings, where he just keeps beating everyone in what should be a drawn ending. How can a 2800 player lose a drawn ending? But they do routinely against, you know, Caruana routinely loses, especially like in rapid against Carlsen. Like drawn endings, Nakamura, drawn ending, oh, Carlsen wins, you know. That's Carlsen's entire power virtually is winning, being able to win impossible to win endings and assessment power. Those are his two incredible skills. He Carlson assesses better than any player in the world right now. He can look at a position that's just insane, and he'll know one side is winning and one side is losing, or it's equal. You know, I don't know how he does it. Only an engine and him can know the truth of a position, but that's his real power, his assessment.
Yeah, I know some people are already thinking like, oh, if Gukesh wins, maybe that'll entice Carlson, because that's what we would love to see. But on the topic of this match, so do you have any opening predictions from Gukesh in particular?
I think he'll move around. I just think he'll move around. He'll play e4 a few games. He might play knight f3 and d4 a few games. I just think he'll test and probe, especially with white. With black, if he's really willing to take a risk, he may try Karakhan. This is if he's really confident, you know, because
although Ding's more likely to play d4 stuff, right? Like.
Yeah. I think Ding will probably stick with his c4 or d4.
Yeah.
And I think Ding did really well with, he won a Collie and a London. By the way, all London haters, I want to get this in, Ben. It's very important. The London has a 100% score in World Championship match history. I just want you to know that, okay?
So. I feel like, you know, I mean, I know the London haters are still out there, but honestly, I feel like it's won the war. I mean, it's like, it's played very commonly at the highest level.
Yeah, it's clearly.
It's gone up and other openings have come down is the other thing.
Right,
so,
So it's no different than playing a Roy Lopez. Like, Black can equalize in every opening. So if Black can equalize eventually with perfect play, like, it'll show plus equals for a while, but if you play computer perfectly, it's equal after about 20 moves, okay? Yeah. Every opening is like that virtually. And so if that's the truth of Roy Lopez, why is it better to play a Roy Lopez than a London? I had like the world champion London hater in San Diego. His name was Bruce Baker. He passed away a few years back. But we played over 400 times, okay? And we'd play every Saturday virtually at Gambito's for 17 years, right? And he would, he would tell me, oh, the London, you know, you have to have something wrong with your head to play London. You hate chess because you play London. And, I think we played in that 17 years, 50 Londons. I didn't lose one game against him. He was a 2300 plus player. Okay. I know I'm higher rated, but I'm not supposed to go 50 games without a loss, but I did with that one opening. Okay. And there's something to that opening. I could play any other opening, and there's no way I could go 50 games without a loss against a 2330 player, right? They'll clip me one game. I'll have a bad day. I'll overpress one game. It's impossible. But only with the London did I go 50 games without a loss, you know, approximately. So there's something to that opening. It's not just you can play for a win safely, and there's a real power to that.
Yeah, and I agree with your overall assessment that Gukesh will probe him, because I suspect, I mean, Ding, I think, you know, his openings have always been good, and I think they'll be fine, but it just seems like Gukesh seems very focused and to put in a ton of hours, so it just feels like he's going to be very confident in his ability to sort of try different things and see where he can make some headway.
I think Gukesh is basically more talented than Ding. I think he has more natural ability than Ding. Ding is immensely talented, but Gukesh is even more. Yeah. And I think that will be the factor. I also, Gukesh, there's something cold and ruthless about him that Ding doesn't have. I can sense it. There's that cold, a Karpovian ruthlessness, like an assassin who it's not personal. It's just my job to kill you. Right. That kind of thing. Like the mob enforcer doesn't hate the guy. He's got a contract to kill. It's just his job. That's how he sees it. Like Kasparov, you could see, you know, the hate, Korchnoi, hate. I'm coming to get you. I don't sense that with Gukesh. There's no, I'm coming to hate you. It's just my job to kill you. Right. You know, nothing personal, but I'm going to kill you, you know, yeah. Like I get that vibe from him, you know?
Yeah. Well, Cyrus, unfortunately, it's been unanimous. I will spoil it for listeners who haven't heard the third segment yet. But yeah, seems like everyone thinks Ding's going to win. But to sum up what I think is an important point, you're saying in terms of like, as we watch and evaluate how the match unfolds, if we get a couple draws early, or obviously if Ding wins one, then you think we might be in for a long, close match. But if Ding stumbles early, it could get ugly. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's right. I think if Ding can draw the first six games, Gukesh will get nervous and say, hey, what's going on? I'm supposed to be ahead by now. Also, but if Ding loses game one, for instance, Ding is a notoriously bad starter, by the way.
Right. Yeah.
He often loses game one, and he's rusty, unless he's playing secret matches with Bu Zhangji, maybe. I don't know. I mean, if he's rusty and loses game one, he's done. Gukesh will not let him get up again. And yeah. it will encourage Gukesh more. But people forget there's immense pressure on Gukesh. Like the Indian press is basically acting like the election is over, you right. know, okay, Gukesh is our new prime minister of India, and he's the world champion, and he's the national hero. Hey, he still has to win the match, guys. Calm down, you know. If you read the Indian press, they act like he's already won the match, you know.
That's interesting. It's
like they're buying the champagne, the party's ready, you know. Right. It's kind of like sort of like the 2016 election in the U.S., you know, where right. everybody thought Hillary would win, you know, and it didn't turn out that way. I mean, you know, so we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. Like, there's a different feel to a world championship match. People react differently. Like, people play much worse than normal in a world championship match. They make horrible blunders. There's, you know, nobody wants to be Bogolyubov'd, okay, where you're the challenger twice and you lose twice, and you're a great player, but you're really, in your heart, you know, you're a footnote in history rather than one of the gods in the pantheon. Okay,
yeah.
You have to win the world championship to be in the pantheon. You cannot be a great challenger, or even a non-challenger like Kyrgios or Rubinstein, or, you know, who never got a shot, right?
Right.
We don't. If you get a shot, you need to win.
He's 18, so I mean, if he loses, he can recover, but.
Easily,
but they always say in sports, you know, you can't take it for granted. You can't assume you'll be back next year. You know, all that stuff applies as well.
You know what? There's Aragassi is not going to be moving aside for
Abdusatarov or Kaimer. Yeah,
exactly. There's a million great rivals.
Prague,
There's no guarantee he will ever get to this place again. If he even a great player can have a bad candidates, you know, like Nakamura came so close two times. Okay. Nakamura would have been Nepomniachtchi's challenger had he held Ding to a draw in that final game. And he was drawing and couldn't.
Yeah. And I forgot Ferruzzo, which that itself speaks volumes, because he was the anointed one, you know, a few years back. And now
I don't think Ferruzzo is going to be a world champion. I make that prediction right now. He's too erratic. He might do it like Tall, but he reminds me of Tall. He's incredibly erratic.
Yeah.
And I think he's becoming a blitz and bullet specialist. See, Gukesh is not a a blitz and bullet specialist. I think he's like he's strongest in like Caruana is much stronger in classical time controls than he is in blitz, although he did pretty damn well in this last the 960, whatever it's called, the Fisher random thing.
Yeah, he's doing well in anything, but we should wrap it up, Cyrus. So
okay. Thank you,
so
Ben.
Thank you. Really enjoyed the book. Great way to get to know Gukesh's incredible chess talent. So I know you've got like six other books in the works. What are you working on, Cyrus?
Well, I've got a book coming out soon on Nakamura.
Oh, fun.
I'm working on a 4-volume series on Capablanca. Then I've got a book coming out next month from Everyman on, it's called The Greatest, Who's the Greatest of All Time. And I pick different categories and then overall the greatest. I pick Kasparov as the greatest of all time. Yeah. And I pick Carlsen as number two. I picked this will get me into horrible trouble, but I picked Karpov as number three over Fisher.
Yeah,
and
that's
Fisher
not, at number that's not four. Crazy. Yeah,
I will get hate mail, Ben. The Fisher people, of course, want him at number one, and but I put him down to number four because he didn't defend his title, and he was only good. He was greatest in maybe one metric of domination. He might have been the greatest of all time in endgames, but I doubt it. Carlsen, I think, is the greatest of all time. And Capablanca, too, would be a rival for that.
Yeah.
But there's only one clear metric where he's ahead of everyone, and that's domination over rivals for a short period of time. I looked at longevity. Then I have a book on the London coming out.
Why you gave the London speech.
No, I give the London speech even if I hadn't written a book. Right. It's my religion, Ben. Yeah. Anyway, then I have a 3-volume series coming out for what was Quality Chess on strategic play for players maybe 1300 to 2000.
Sounds good. Okay, well, a lot to look forward to as always, Cyrus, and thank you for sharing your perspective. Gun to my head, I don't think it's going to be that close a match, but I hope I'm wrong, and you do give me some early markers to look out for.
Right. Thank you so much, Ben. Appreciate
it. Okay, great to catch up. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
After the break, statistician and national master Matt Jensen will join us for a statistical breakdown of the World Championship match. We'll be right back. And we are here with returning guest Matt Jensen. He is a national master, a statistician, and a co-founder of the chess education site, chessgoals.com. We had him helpfully preview the last World Championship. He's always got lots of little statistical nuggets that are interesting. He's also a bit of an expert on ratings. He's done a lot of research on ratings across different websites. So we may touch on that towards the end. But of course, the primary order of business is to get a statistical look at the World Championship and to welcome Matt back to the pod. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you, Ben, for having me back. I was very excited to see your email asking if I could run some simulations of the World Chess Championship, and I'm excited to dive in with you.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that excitement because, of course, emotions run the gamut for this Magnus-less World Championship. For me, it's still distinctly better than nothing, and there is a sort of, I feel like there's more of a voyeuristic aspect to this one, which is not 100% a good thing, but with so much speculation about which Ding will show up at this match, I do feel like that alone does build some anticipation, if not some suspense, about what the most likely result might be. Are you excited as a fan for this match, Matt?
I'm more excited than I have been in the past couple matches, and it's because of the challenger, Gukesh D, and we're going to dive more into this, but I think the fact that he's so young really could become something exciting in terms of the next 10 years even.
Yeah, I'm warming up to that point of view. So one question, and we'll definitely get into that. And of course, I haven't recorded with Cyrus discussing Gukesh yet, but listeners will have already heard that on this podcast. But one question is, did you feel like just from a statistical modeling perspective, the fact that Ding's performance rating has covered a wider range than a typical world championship, especially defender, but even challenger, did that make it more challenging to model for you?
That's a good question. You know, I think the current FIDE ratings are sort of a lagging indicator of how strong players are performing. So I ran this model a couple different ways, and really Gukesh D is coming out the favorite pretty much any way we spin it. Unless we go back and say, what if Ding played at his prime level?
Right.
Which we're going to get into a little bit with his age, but I don't think that's probably a likely scenario at this point.
Yeah, because that was one of the sort of brainstorming exercises I had flagged for you. So why do you think that that's not the most helpful potential scenario?
So I looked at different players and sort of when they hit their peak rating. And I think the issue for Ding is he's already, let's see, he was 2800 at age 30. Now he's already 32 years old. And if we look at past players that have been over 2800 or number two in the world, a lot of them, they reach that number two level. They only hang around there for a few months and then they drop off. And if they're already in their 30s, they don't tend to make it back up. There are some exceptions, but I think chances are Ding never quite gets back up to that level.
Yeah, well, certainly his rating is not going to make it back up to that level, but can he channel the performance that he showed 3 years ago is the question.
Yeah, it's possible, but I feel it's pretty unlikely at this point, because when's the last time he showed us this 2800 level? And if anything, you know, this is not based on data, but looking at how he performs on the big stage, he just seems even extra nervous lately if there's a lot of pressure on him.
Yeah, unfortunate, but probably correct observation. So could you find, I know in our last conversation, we also discussed aging and vying for a world championship a bit, could you think of any exceptions of players who peaked, you know, past 30 that were at the uber elite? Players do peak past 30. It's just they're not usually one of the top few in the world.
Yeah, I think Hikaru is one of them. You know, he was already up pretty high, dropped back down for a while, got into streaming, and then he's shown that he can get back up to that 2800 plus level. But there's a lot of players who, once they've fallen, they never really come back. So I think that's more likely. Caruana might be an exception in terms of just he stayed at the top for so long.
Yeah.
We really haven't seen that in a long time.
Yeah, and of course, there's historical examples like Korchnoi and Smyslov, players achieving great things at late ages, but it's usually, even if they like qualify for the candidates or play for a world championship or whatever it might be, usually it's not a peak rating to go along with that. That would be rare.
Yes, that's right. And one of the things that I've found doing data analysis of chess improvers, so if we extrapolate this down to lower ratings, having a higher rating and also being an older age makes it more difficult to keep your rating up and to increase your rating. And this is the far extreme. So we're talking highest peak ratings of all ratings. It makes it very difficult to gain any points. And even for, let's say, someone like myself, a national master or yourself, it's very hard for us to gain rating points because we're already at an age in combination with our ratings where it's difficult to get, let's say, an extra 50 points of ELO.
You're depressing me.
I'm sorry.
but yeah, I mean, so Korchnoi, by the way, his rating did peak in the late 40s. So there are exceptions, but certainly I agree with your broader point. And there's also the unique story with Ding in that it's not necessarily like, you know, chess players, as far as we know, hit their peak because their fluid intelligence reaches a peak and their calculation might get a bit less sharp. And, you know, that starts possibly in your 30s, but then accelerates as you go on. So Ding is not far off of what would be considered a chess player's peak moment. But the other thing about Ding is I feel like so much of his decline might be psychologically based that it does seem like maybe he could get it back. But on the other hand, he just feels so far off. And the rating reflects how far off him being nearly, you know, 70 some points lower rated than his peak at, which at the top level is a huge amount.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if Ding were to get back to his kind of prior form or close to it, I would like to see it leading up to the World Championship. Not trying to make the assumption that all of a sudden he'll turn it on just for this match. It would have been nice to see, like, okay, he's rebounding up. He's peaking at the championship instead of just coming out of nowhere from this valley to reach his highs again.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like maybe I'm just trying to talk myself into to a suspenseful match, but unfortunately, I do think it's less likely to be what we see. So you dug up some interesting stats, as we always do, related to like different scenarios that could unfold. So first of all, I know you dug up some relating to the draw rate. You know, people often complain about draws in classical chess. Do you think this is a match where there's likely to be more draws than usual or fewer?
So I built a data set on the last 19 World Chess Championship matches. This is going back to 1985, Kasparov against Karpov. And I had modeled the data based on a bunch of input factors to see what's the expected draw rate. And the expected draw rate that I came up with for this match is 65%, when the long-term average is 70% across all the matches. And in Carlsen matches specifically, it's 76%. And the reasons for this is, number one, the two players have a low average rating, which is kind of brought down by Ding's rating, right? And also we see a large rating difference between the two players, meaning Gukesh has a higher expected win percentage, so we're more likely to get a decisive outcome. So I think you combine those factors, I would expect a low draw rate. And my excitement, Ben, comes from the fact that Gukesh might just blow Ding Liren out of the water. And we just see this new world champion who is sort of the next Magnus Carlsen. That's kind of the angle I'm hoping for, more so than a close match. Like, I want to see Gukesh D just become a dominant world champion going forward.
Yeah, and that almost seems more likely than Ding turning it around and winning the match. I mean, but the thing is, of course, him winning this match, even decisively, would obviously only be the first step. But you did, I know, uncover some interesting research about, I mean, just how rare it is to have an 18-year-old on this stage. Obviously, he would be the youngest world champion ever to win it. And that does give him some potential runway to you know, put his name in the record books for some unusual achievements. One other thing we always like to zero in on is sort of the possibility of a tie break. Now, I'm guessing with the current rating gap and with the, as aforementioned, increased likelihood of decisive results, especially in favor of Gukesh, I'm guessing that your stats say that even ending up in a tie break is not that likely.
So I looked at it two different ways. If we just look at the current ratings, which seems pretty similar to the betting odds. So there's a betting website that shows the odds of Gukesh, Ding, and a tiebreak. And they say 15% chance of a tiebreak. I'm coming up with 13% chance of a tiebreak using what I call the current rating model. But I have an exciting model that I found, Ben, that factors in when the players have an age difference of more than 12 years. So we've only seen this three times. Kasparov beating Karpov, Kramnik defeating Kasparov, and Carlsen defeating Anand. So all of these matches were sort of like passing of the torch matches where we have a new world champion and they became dominant for quite a long stretch. And if I use that model, we're only looking at a 3% chance of a tiebreak because I'm seeing a 93% chance that Gukesh wins in the classical.
Yeah, that's crazy. And to be clear, so first of all, nuts and bolts, do you just, so you call it a age bonus, do you just give them extra elo and run it as if they were a higher elo? Or I don't know how much you can get into the mechanics of the model, but I'm curious how you would input something like that.
Yeah, so essentially in those matches, the expected score for the younger player was higher than the expected score just based on the ratings. So it increased his expected score about 7% per game, which across the series of a whole match of up to 14 games makes a huge difference. And I know it's a small sample size with just three prior matches, but I think it's something interesting in the data that could potentially show that Gukesh may blow Dinglerin out of the water just based on the fact that he's the younger player in combination with the ELO difference.
Right. And it gets back to the point you raised about rating being a lagging indicator with these uber young stars. I mean, Kramnik, I think, was a bit older, but certainly Carlson and Kasparov, when they were taking the title, their rating may not have caught up to their strength, which may, again, we're drawing inferences based on admittedly statistically insignificant samples, but it's all we have.
Right.
But do you think that, could you, for our listeners, explain why rating is a lagging indicator?
Yeah. So if you have a rating of, let's say, 2750, and you perform at 2650 for a full year, each time you lose a game against a similarly rated player, you're probably only losing 5 rating points. So it takes quite a while to get that rating all the way down to the level you're performing at.
Right. Which in Ding's case may be holding his rating up, but in Gukesh's case could be keeping a lid on his rating because he may have made strength gains that he hasn't been able to demonstrate yet.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all pointing in one direction. And, you know, stats hat aside, you know, we're recording this on Halloween. The election's coming. I've been listening to a lot of election podcasts, and they always ask the data nerds, you know, like, I know your data says 60-40, but what do you think's going to happen? And then they're always like, 60-40. That's what I'm trying to say. But I'm going to ask you the same question. Like, I know your data says in some scenarios, 93%, in more base case, maybe 80. But what do you think's going to happen, Matt?
That's a great question. So the current rating model is 76% chance Gukesh, 24% Ding. And the model with that age factor with the 12-year age gap is 94-6. I think it's going to be somewhere in between. I would put this at about 85% Gukesh, just kind of going by feel, and a 15% chance for Ding. And I think Ding's path to winning this match is he needs to have a boring match, a lot of draws, where he gets back to that style where he just never loses a game. And we haven't talked about who's the favorite in the Rapid, but I think Dinglerin might be have a slight lead in the Rapid and Blitz, just because he has higher FIDE ratings in those categories. Gukesh D doesn't seem to be one of these youngsters that's playing all this Blitz online. And when they do play Blitz online, Dinglerin has a 100-point higher rating on chess.com.
So that might be his best chance, because beating him in Classical could be an even taller order. And I was saying to Grandmaster Davor and Cole Yasevich, who listeners will have heard in the first segment, like, there was sort of, at least for me, a sense that Ding almost won accidentally against Nepo by getting to the tiebreak. And yeah, so that's sort of the roadmap, yes. He might need to follow again. Yeah, it'll be interesting. But I have to say, I echo your sentiment that, like, if I, at the betting market odds, the ones I found were on Bwin, yeah, they were in the neighborhood of 75% for Gukesh. I would rather bet Gukesh laying 3-1 than getting odds on Ding, which brings me no pleasure to say that, but like you say, I mean, it'd be fun to have another potentially dominant champion. And obviously this is a capstone on the sort of stratospheric rise we've seen in Indian, a potential capstone in Indian chess in the past few years.
We'll be back with more with NM Matt Jensen.
Any other world championship thoughts, Matt? Any other data you wanted to share?
I think the only other thing is, if we look at the expected score, I'm expecting about a 7.5 to 4.5 win for Gukesh D. And I think somewhere around +2 or +3 is sort of what I would expect for the average win for Gukesh. And if there's a blowout, it's going to be Gukesh winning, I think.
Yeah, so almost extremely unlikely that Ding wins comfortably.
Right.
Again, thinking out loud, but your age. So there's a lot of talk of nerves. Will Gukesh be up to the moment? You know, of course, we've seen zero evidence that he has any sort of issues in that regard. But we also should reiterate that your data shows no issue when these youngsters, I mean, again, limited sample, but when these youngsters do reach the big stage, they seem to figure out how to acclimate to more cameras and more media attention and all that stuff.
Yeah. And it almost seems like the opposite might be a potential concern for Gukesh. Does he get overconfident?
Right.
Everyone's talking about him winning. So it's not like he's coming up against, let's just say, a 40-year-old Magnus Carlsen and trying to take the title and has nerves. He's already sort of surpassed Dingler N by quite a wide margin. And now he's trying to tell himself, hey, we have a close match going on here. I'm not a 70 ELO point favorite.
Yeah, although he does have a minus score against him, as Cyrus Lakdawala has detailed in his book. So he hasn't caught him recently enough to put that score in the positive. So maybe that will sort of help him stave off overconfidence. But I guess we'll know in about a month from when we're recording this, Matt. So what else is going on with you and Jesse? You're the co-founders of a chess educational site called Chess Goals. They have some great study plans and original research, again, regarding ratings and what to study. What have you guys been working on lately?
Lately, we've been working on a modern defense course from the black side. I'm really excited about this course because it's a full repertoire for black against anything white can throw at you. It's going to be about 100 lines, so it's not a lot of lines, but within each chapter, I'm adding multiple model games. So the idea is get a feel for the different structures, how to play the positions, and we like to keep our opening courses at a level where it's easy enough to study the data and just look at what you need to learn. So that's the next course coming out. And if people are interested in getting started with Chess Goals, we have a coupon code for listeners to the podcast. It's Ben2024, so Ben2024. And that will save you 30% off any courses. And we have a bunch of free courses too. Like we have one called the Chess Goals Blueprint, and that's based on our study plan data. What are the best ways to study to improve your chess?
Yeah, and we talked about this some in our prior interview, but one TLDL to reiterate is Matt is a big, and this is data-based, is a big advocate of learning by playing. Could you give your spiel for that, Matt?
Yes. So looking at the data, I've found that players should play. So thinking in terms of your chess time as playing versus studying, you should play at a very minimum 50% of the time of your overall chess time to improve. And that 50% can go all the way up to about 90 or 95%. At least for some small stretches, to try to maximize your rating gain. So I find with adult improvers, we all get busy and a lot of us have egos tied to our chess ratings, right? We don't want to see our ratings drop. So we fear playing in events. But really what happens is then you end up just studying books or studying online courses, but you never apply what you're learning. So you need to have that combination of learning things and applying things. And that shows in the data as well. So I always tell people, play more chess. It's like the number one tip I give players, even if it's blitz chess or rapid chess, which is somewhat controversial.
Yeah. And we did talk about this a little bit. And obviously, as I wrote in my book, I mean, I'm a big advocate of playing games that you consider serious, you know. So as long as you're not like, you know, multitasking or playing 1 minute chess, like as long as you're able to find a way to make it feel like you really don't want to lose, that's sort of the trigger for learning. The errors that you make in these games that really annoy you when you lose is the trigger for learning. But I'm definitely directionally on board with that advice. And of course, as I wrote about and has been discussed in many places, if you look at the rises of people like Hikaru, there's my book. So much of his rise, now we're not all Hikaru, of course, but so much of his rise was just done by iterating, play, review, or even just play. And I don't even know if he was reviewing half the time, but the rest of us probably have to review. Well, excellent. So I will link to everything that Matt mentioned regarding chess goals. Do you know, Matt, will you be, so Matt, for those who don't know, often runs stats for chess.com when they show different probabilities and stuff like their flagship events. It's often based on his data. Do you have anything in the pipeline with chess.com?
I'm talking to them right now, but as of this recording, nothing has been finalized. They also have a larger stats team than they've had in the past. So it's possible they'll be doing their models in-house, but I hope to at least do something for them, whether it's a full article or maybe just kind of inserting my stats into one of their pieces.
Okay. And last thing, again, we're recording this like 3 weeks before the match, but will you and Jesse be covering the match at all? I know you guys have a Discord, right? Chatting about it in the Discord, if nothing else, I assume.
Yeah, at a minimum, we will be chatting about it in the Discord, and we'll be chatting about it on our podcast, which is called No Pawn Intended. But in terms of live coverage, I don't think we'll do live coverage, but I would like to do some recaps on the YouTube channel.
Excellent. Okay, well, I will link to all of Matt's stuff. And Matt, always appreciate the analytical perspective. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I would say I hope we're wrong. I like max suspense. I get what you're saying about like the rise of a new superstar, you know, the potential for historical dominance that Gukesh has before him. But the current me, the right now me, wants to be entertained, you know? So yeah. So I'm sort of hoping that your data is wrong, but I suspect it probably isn't. But thanks again, Matt. Appreciate it as always.
Thank you, Ben, for having me on. I enjoyed it.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
What's something that works so well that it's basically magic? This time of year, I think of air conditioning. But selling with Shopify is also seamless. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling chess courses, merch, software services, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person point-of-sale system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify's magic, which is your AI-powered all-star. When I was running an online teaching business, enabling seamless online payment saved me many hours of work and helped me focus on what I enjoy. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries use it, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. So if you sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/chess, that's all lowercase, shopify.com/chess, to sign up to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in growing it. Shopify.com/chess.